was going to say, I shouldn't admit this on the recording. That's the first thing that's going to be recorded. So I'm just coming to you also as a parent from children who are across the spectrum. So I have kids who are very Orthodox, to kids who are lightly Orthodox, to kids who are lazy Orthodox, to kids who are not Orthodox, to kids who are actively atheist. So my parenting paradigm as a maturing mother is holding the bouquet, that each child is their very own blossom, and it is not my job to make them into me. It is my job to encourage and respect the flower that they are and gently hold them together in the bouquet of our family as the mother of the family. So that's what I'm working on now. So that's the perspective that I'm coming from. And with that, I want to share with you power track parenting. How can you be a powerful parent at this stage in your life? So I just want to know, who has a teen at home right now? Just raise your hand. Okay, that's most of you, right? And even if you don't have a teen at home, you've had or you have young adults, this applies to young adults too, because it turns out parenting does not end. When I first got married, I lived in an apartment building. We didn't know where to live, right? I met my husband in Israel. He was in law school in America. We both were very clear about what we wanted in a spouse, extremely clear. We had our clear lists. I wanted to stay in Israel forever, so I was not even going to date somebody who spoke English, not even as a second language, very clear. And he really wanted like a traditional family. He wanted a girl with Yiddish-speaking parents. And God had so much fun with us putting us together, because he got Geisha parents in law and I got somebody who speaks English beautifully. And now I live in the States. So that's what they say, that man plans and God laughs. And so he has a good time with us. So anyway, so when we first got married, I was living in Israel. His living with his parents going to law school in Manhattan. So I moved into the 92nd Street Y, MHA, just close by to his parents' house. We lived there until we got married. I mean, I lived there. He lived with his parents, and we got married. We didn't know where to move. We moved to Long Island into the apartment that was his grandparents' apartment. They had both died. It was a co-op, so his mother owned it. So we moved into that apartment, which was a building full of Jewish grandparents. Who were the youngest by 50 years? 60, probably. Everybody was Jewish in the whole building, except for the help, of course. And everybody was in their 80s, and we were in our 20s. So all my friends, my entire floor, 14 apartments, was all Jewish old ladies. There were two husbands on the floor. Three husbands on the whole floor, and the rest were widows. And then us. My was the fourth husband. So I really saw it. They were my friends, really friends. One day I took out the trash. I was throwing with the compact room in an apartment building. I was throwing it down the chute. And Ruth Mandelbaum was there throwing hers down the chute. And she said, "Aliza, are you a member of AARP?" And I said, "AARP?" I said, "Do you mean the American Association of Retired Persons?" She said, "Yeah, are you a member?" I'm like, "Ruth, no, I'm not. I'm 60 years younger than you." Like, she just forgot we were friends, you know, like we're just friends on the hall. So anyway, so we would fold our laundry together in the laundry room, and to a woman, every single woman in that building said, "I wish I would have had more kids." And I thought to myself at that time, with my two kids, first one and then two, and they'd be in the stroller while we'd be folding laundry together, and I thought, like, you know, I was thinking four, but every single woman said, "I wish I would have had more kids." And I thought to myself, you know what? I don't want to be one of those. I don't want to wish that when I can't anymore. I think I'll have a couple extra now while I still can. And so I did have six. So, and I'm so thankful, because it really is, at this stage of parenting, it's fabulous having this group of engaging, terrific, difficult, challenging, blossoming young adults in my life. I love it. Love it. So whoever has kids or having kids, tell them to have an extra few kids, because it's so much fun having the adults. It's a ton of work. So I do remember telling my mother, who was very concerned how many kids you're having, you know, I was definitely raised with ZPG consciousness, zero population growth, you know, two per family, that's it. It's our responsibility to the planet to only replace ourselves and to have no more than that. And it was a very clear part of my childhood upbringing that that was it. So my mother was quite concerned, you know, four, that's one thing she could understand. Now I'm Jewish, we have this obligation, you know, replace the Jewish people, blah, blah, blah. But six? You know, so I told her my perspective. I said, you know, it's like, really, it's an 18-year investment that pays dividends for life. And she looked at me and said, oh, no, it is not an 18-year investment. It is a lifelong project. So as a cute young thing, I had no clue that it's a lifelong project, especially because I moved out at 16. Right, so I raised myself from 16. I went to Israel, and that was back in the day when there really weren't phones that worked in Israel. Or it was hard to have access to them, so I didn't call home. We wrote aerograms, right? And that's how I communicated. And I didn't even communicate that much. My mother sent me a postcard once that said, I waited and waited, and when no message came, I knew it must be from you. So I was not that in touch. And actually, it was a parenting challenge for me when my oldest turned 17. And she came into the kitchen one day, and you know, I was a little health foodie, so I taught my kids to read the side of the cereal box. 6 sugars and below is a weekday cereal. 7 and above is a Shabbos cereal, right? So she came into the kitchen one day. Can she have Cinnamon Toast Crunch 12 for breakfast? It was a Wednesday. So I looked at her and I said, Elisheva, you're 17. You can decide for yourself which cereals you eat on which days of the week. That's no longer like, I released her. But I remember like having a hard time with what do you do with a 17-year-old? I wasn't parented at 17. How do you parent somebody that you weren't, like, what was my model? I didn't have a model for that. And so moving into parenting teens was a whole new model for me, and realizing how to parent young adults and still be in that relationship, and the shifting roles of it, and what that relationship is. So I found, of course, in the early days, read lots of parenting books, how to do this, and how do you toilet train, how do you get them from stop to hit, right? How do you get them to sleep through the night, all that stuff, all situational stuff. But what's the goal of parenting? Like, not just situation, not just how do you put out the fires, but what are you trying to accomplish? So my parents definitely raised me towards independence. So I even saw that as situational. Even when I was a little girl, if we'd take a flight somewhere in the airport, they would tell my sister and myself, she's 14 months younger than me, it's just the two of us, they would say, we're going to Chicago on United, find the gate. And they'd walk behind us. Right? So it would be our job to find the sign, read the chart, figure out the gate, take the direction. And they would walk behind us so that we would learn how to navigate. But they did that all the time. You know, go to the store and find this, or bring that, or whatever. Like, they really raised us for launching. So I was raised with that consciousness, which is different than in many Jewish families I've noticed, which there's a lot of doing for and keeping in. You know, there's the Hebrew letter Samech is shaped like a circle, and that is a feminine letter, whatever that means. In Kabbalistic terms, it's feminine. So it's shaped like a hug, which it is a hug, or a prison. Right? It could be either one. So it depends on what your embrace is about. Is the embrace about hugging or about impeding, about entrapment? And the line is very thin. You have to figure out where we're holding on that line. And launching can also be too much of a project where people don't feel cared for. So I definitely faced some of that too. You know, you want a ride. Okay, you want 40 minutes of my time. I want 40 minutes of yours. First clean the kitchen, and then you can have a ride. We'll trade times, you know. So that could be frustrating. Something I chose not to do with my own children. I definitely want a ride. Where to? A little getting back at my parents for that. So the goal of parenting, though, really is independence. And so we understand this concept through the Hebrew word for camel. Do you know how to say camel in Hebrew?
Gamal.
That's right. Gamal, camel, is the same root of the word gemilut chasadim. You hear the gamal and gemilut chasadim, acts of loving kindness. Lihigamel means to wean somebody. So we have these words of giving, gemilut, giving an act of kindness, gamal, a camel, lehi gamel, to wean. It's all the same root. So we have this idea in Hebrew of hubs and spokes. Really in classic Hebrew, I always think differently than everybody else. So classically, it would be called a root, and there's branches. But I see hubs and spokes. So the hub is the root, right? Gimel, mem, lamet. That's the hub. And the spokes are weaning, camels, giving, right? All these different things are manifestations from that. What comes out of that? Numbers too. Sometimes when you hear gematrias, those are just different spokes that come from that root. So, but it must be that if there's one hub, that all the words are connected. So how do you connect camel and giving and weaning? Because the root is the same in them all. So the idea is that a camel is independent, right? Can walk through the desert for a long time. Great pack animal. They have all that, whatever there is in their hump for them. But they can be independent of a source of nourishment for a very long time. But only because they really took in a lot when they could take it in. Right? So how does weaning work into that? This is our parenting process. Give, 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 so you can wean so they can be independent. That's really how it all comes together. Our job as parents is to create independent beings through giving and then weaning. So there has to be the polarity of giving and weaning so that they can be independent. But the goal has to be independence. Whatever, machine's making noise there. Great. One of the ways I got through parenting my little kids, when sometimes I would be going a little nuts, right? 6 kids in 7.5 years, right? So it's like it's really a pack of them. And of course, I'm sure you all are familiar with and probably past that surreal feeling like, could this really be my life? Am I really independent? Like when we first got married, we couldn't believe we could close the door and we're alone. Hey, that's so great. Could it be possible that we're allowed to do all this stuff and we have our own apartment and whatever we want? It's great, right? And then I remember so clearly one day that we took all 6 kids in our 12-passenger van. We went to the pet store. We bought a fish tank and everything in it. And we loaded all the kids back and buckled all the car seats and put the tank in the back of the car. And everybody's holding their little baggie of their fish, right? And we went around the back to close the van. We slammed the doors shut, each of us. And then we looked at each other like, oh my gosh, look at us. This is all ours. Like, all these kids and all these car seats and the fish. Like, we're in charge of all of it. How could it be that we have like so much on our plates? Like, this is huge, right? So one of the tricks that I used to use to stay calm, and I'm a pretty calm mom, was not really a big yeller, but I still had to work on it. So one of my tricks was pretending that I was babysitting. Because you don't yell at kids you're babysitting for, right? They're somebody else's kid. So you gotta scream at them. It's pretty easy to scream at your own. So I would just imagine that I'm babysitting for who? For the adult that's inside that child. Because there is an adult inside that child who's going to come eventually and take that child away. But the only difference between that adult and babysitting for somebody else's child and when that adult comes is that adult that takes away your child knows everything you did. Unlike when you babysit for money, right? That adult knows nothing that you did. You could give them candy all day long just to keep them quiet so you can be on Facebook, and that adult's not going to know because they're going to say, I love going to so-and-so's house, right? So, but your kid's going to know everything. Your adult that's hidden inside your child is going to know everything. So I would really try to focus on the adult that's there and that I'm responsible to that adult. So I have to raise this child in a way that I'll be able to look that adult in the eyes and say, I did right by you. So that really helped me keep my voice in check and keep my anger in check and keep my goals on the adult that's there. Not on putting out this fire, but on raising an independent, healthy, happy individual. So I think I mostly achieved most of that. Even with my child who unfortunately took his life, we were very happy together. And he even consulted me about best ways to do it. And he even didn't take my advice, but he did. I mean, I didn't say how I wanted him to do it. I just told him how I didn't want to do it, which he didn't do it that way. So I appreciated that. But we had the conversation, you know, to have that kind of closeness where, Ema, I am going to do it. How should I, what's your preferred method? Old age, okay? Let's do old age. But he chose not that one. But at least we had the closeness and we had the relationship of love and caring and responsibility and giving. So I would say that's really what you want. In power parenting It's giving and weaning at the same time, especially with teens. It's such a challenge. Whose teen is their oldest at home? Like, do you have your, who's struggling now with an oldest? So that's really a hard time of teen parenting, is figuring out your oldest, because it's such a transition time. So here's an image that I like to think about in parenting. The difference between lobsters and human beings. Right? There's a lot of differences, but the difference I want to talk about. They're both treif. Okay, don't eat either one. But lobsters have their skeleton on the outside, human, and their soft stuff on the inside. Human beings have their skeleton on the inside and their soft stuff on the outside. So the structure for the lobster is all external. When we parent little children, we have to parent them like lobsters. We provide the structure to keep them safe. But we have to flip them into human beings, where the structure is internal, their vulnerables external, and so that the structure is inside them. Because we can't, it turns out, follow them everywhere. From a very young age, they can take a window out of the house, they can take your car without permission, they can take whatever they want into their bodies, whether it's calories or chemicals, whatever they want. It's up to them. You don't get to pick. The only way you have influence is if you get the structure to be internal. If you create a consensus with what's desired and they buy into your plan. If they don't buy into your plan, they'll do whatever they want. Right? They'll anyway do whatever they want. You just want them to want what you want. So you try to convince them that what you want is good for them. But that's really the flip that has to be made, is from where will the structure come? From me providing it or from you providing it? And that's the flip that has to occur somewhere between 8 and... It starts at about 8. You have to start flipping into having the structure come from inside. But, so that's a controlled plan from about age 8 till about 12, 13, 14 if you're super lucky, but 14 is really the outside edge. After that, they really are on their own. You've created what you can create, and the only thing that you still have left to give is if they want it. Because otherwise they can rebel or do whatever, as you know, do whatever they want. Unless you've created a warm enough embrace that they seek your advice and attention and guidance. I remember once we had a parenting class. I had a kid in a modern Orthodox school. They brought in a YU parenting expert. He had his PhD. He's busy giving parenting advice. He's clearly somewhat behind the ears, a little whippersnapper, 32 or something like that. His oldest kid was 9, and he's giving advice. I'm thinking, that is so cute. You read it in a book. Nice. Come back after you've had some teenagers, okay? Then we'll talk about parenting. You know, like, I asked him some question. He said, well, maybe you could try taking away their cell phone. I'm like, really? That's like putting them... Yeah. That's what I was like, yeah, that's really going to work. Limit cell phone time. Good. You just extrapolated from limiting computer time for your 9-year-old. That's good. It's not the same, okay? Teenagers are different creatures altogether. You can't know what you're into. That's why when I see a mom, I did not do this. When I see a mom who has a teenager and is pregnant, I'm like, you are so brave because you know what you're getting into. And you're doing it again. That's great. Good for you. I did it before I knew it all. My first was like such an angel darling. And she's the one that Hashem tricked me with. He's like, don't you want a bunch of these? I was like, yes. Yes, I do. I want a lot. So I had a lot. None of them were like her at all. They all had their different challenges. It took a long time to figure it out. My father did not come often for visits. I had one child who's... I had a lot of kids who were particularly... Everybody had their thing. Anyway, but I did score big with my dad one time. He came on that visit. He sees one kid who's like everywhere all the time. He's like, what's going on with this child? Which I had wondered myself and discussed with my Rebbetzin. And she said, you know, it's a test. So I told him what I knew. It's a test. He's like, what do you get if you pass the test? I was like, I don't know. Better go find out. So through consulting with her over the years, I learned that what you get if you pass the test is you. Bigger and stronger, more capacious, more compassionate, more powerful, more loving, more giving, more of who you could be. But each one of those children, each one of those instances, is a custom-designed workshop meant to pull out what's inside you, potential, and bring it to fruition. Because we're still growing ourselves. And we don't have parents parenting us. But Hashem sees what's in there and says, I could pull that out of you. I could make it come out, and I want to see it. So I'm going to give you circumstances that are going to help you, force you. Sometimes Hashem opens the door and says, I invite you to take this workshop with me. I've arranged it just for you. And you look inside and say, nah, I think I'll skip that one. Hashem says, actually, not. And in you go, right? Whatever it is, ADD or learning disabilities or terminal illness or whatever it is, there's all kinds of things that we have to face in life. Marriage challenges, financial challenges, our own health challenges, difficult parents, aging parents, everything, all that stuff is, how could I pull the best out of you? So that is what I have learned when I see it's a test. What's a test is, how can I bring out what's latent potential? How could I develop more? How could I become more? How could I grow more? How can I grow through this? How can I deal with this? And how can I grow through this? Those are the two questions that I try to work with whenever faced with something challenging. How to deal and how to grow. So that's what I've accomplished in this. The one score I had, this one of my sons who was different kind of difficult, he was so high energy and angry. He loved classical music and passionate. He was like 5. I got him a tape called Bombastic Classics. It was like all the crashing, big, noisy, you know, everything classical that was like, I had a lot of power in it. So he was sitting on my father's lap again. He hardly ever visited, like every third year for like 12 hours he would visit. So he says, so what kind of music do you like? And my 5-year-old. He said, I like classical. I said, really? Who's your favorite composer? He said, Beethoven. He said, really? I said, what's your favorite piece of Beethoven? He says, I like Beethoven's 5th symphony. I'm like, score! He only knew that from that one tape, but he knew it! And my father thinks my child's totally educated. Although with that child, I just went to hear Pinchas Zuckerman. It was so nice, because he still loves such a breadth of music and classical music, and we went together to hear Pinchas Zuckerman perform in Denver, which is so nice to see him. Pinchas Zuckerman, you all know who he is, right? He had polio as a child, but he walked to his seat across the stage. It was not easy just to see him uncomfortably. He's probably 70. He was born in 1945, so whatever that is, almost 70 now. Walk across the stage and take his seat and put down his crutches and then pick up the violin, and the magic, you know, the struggle and the magic combined. It was amazing to see. Okay, so if we want to be powerful, we want to shift the paradigm from lobsters to human beings and shift our whole life. So I made a little mnemonic for us to think about power. Okay, so P-O-W-E-R. So we want to grow ourselves, and we want to grow our children. All right, so for growing ourselves, we first have to be proactive. We have to actually, sometimes we get so caught up in things that we forget to actually set goals for ourselves and be proactive and not be reactive to what's going on, but to be proactive, to see who do we want to be and who do we want to become through this whole process. Do you want to just be struggling, or do you want to come out of this part of your life as bigger, stronger, more compassionate, more understanding? Well, what are your goals? Who do you see yourself as, and how will you aim yourself in that direction? So to be proactive. And in terms of raising the children to be healthy adults, the P would be to prioritize. There are times to keep your eyes open and times to keep your eyes shut, right? How do you work? What goals do you have? But actually to think of goals. Because sometimes we can face what's called parenting fatigue, right? You just get like tired, like a whatever, right? I, for a long time, I have a bachelor's degree in Jewish education and in Jewish studies and Hebrew language. And I wanted a master's. And so I couldn't for a long time. Finally, I got a full scholarship to ILF School of Theology. It's a Methodist school of theology. I had asked all the rabbinic questions. May I attend that school? Is it permissible? Yes, you can. I had my full scholarship. Then another Jewish program opened up where I didn't have a full scholarship, but I had all the Jewish studies I wanted. So I went and consulted with my mother, which one should I do, this master's or that master's? My mother's very smart. So she sat me down. This is 10 years ago. Sat me down and said, you have a few days here with me in Oregon, away from your family. Let's sit down and just look at each one of the members of your family and see what do they need over the coming year for their best spiritual, physical, emotional health development. Okay. So we go through each child, and my husband and me, and we make little post-it notes, and we make a whole little chart of every, the tutors, this one needs the therapies, this one needs the dentist appointment, that one needs everything, right? All made. I knew what she was doing, and at the end, she looked at me and said, "With all this, I just don't see how a master's program is going to fit into your life." She said, "I think you are experiencing parenting fatigue." She said, "I think instead of getting your MA, you need to be an MA." So, she was brilliant. Time to turn towards my mothering and turn instead of turning away from my mothering. And it's such a challenge. Anybody who needs to go, no problem.
Do you have a black Mercedes because they're blocking?
I know it's 1 o'clock.
Yes.
I'll wrap it up, but...
No.
Okay. Whoever has to leave at 1, please leave.
I'll take it.
Okay. So, you want to prioritize what are your goals and not shy away from your goals. It's very easy with teens to just say, whatever. They're already, like, I did what I could, and now all I have to do is, like, pay enough to get them through college and then to start them off in life, and then, okay, till they're 30. But then, hopefully, they'll be independent after that, right?
I can certainly ask Dr. Rogers this question, but the similarities between psychology and what you're saying are, I think, are unbelievable.
Yeah.
As far as raising children.
Meaning modern psychology and Jewish thought?
Yes.
I'm sharing both.
Okay.
Yeah, so Jewish thought is definitely raise children towards independence, and we just have to understand how we accomplish that. Really, it says in the Gemara, like, what are your three jobs as a parent? You have to teach your kid to swim. You have to give them a parnasa, a way to earn a living, and marry them off. What is that, though? Those are all independence things. Teaching them how to swim can be both physical and metaphorical. They have to learn how to swim in the world, right? And then they have to become financially independent, and then they need a partner. So you have to raise, there's a lot of prereqs for those three things. So it's the parent's job to give all those prerequisites and bring them to that place, but it really is about launching them. Right? So that is the Torah. The question is, how do we do that? We do that differently in every single generation. I read a fascinating book, and definitely put it on your list. If you haven't read this, you must. It's just an important concept as Jewish women. It's called The Memoirs of Gluckel, of Hamlin. And it's a memoir by Gluckel of Hamlin, and written in 1690. And she's a new widow. She's 44 years old, mother of 14 children. This is not fiction. This is her actual memoir. And so her husband dies, talks about his death, and it talks about how she takes over the family business, which is gems and trading, and how she matches up her children, which are all financial transactions. Who do you marry? What families do you marry into? This is not about romance. This is about how do you match them up, right? How do you create those matches, and how do you raise them? The girls are 14, the boys are 16 when they're married. And they get married, they're children, 14 and 16, right? Nobody even then thought they were ready to be independent, so they got married and moved in, not out. So that they were, until they would have, let's say, baby number three, two or three, that's when they moved out. So that part of parenting in that generation was teaching them how to be married and young mothers, and then they'd be launched. So it's just every generation has their way of doing it according to the way that their society works. But we do, as Jewish mothers, have to ground ourselves back in what's our goal. It's not just letting go. It is giving enough that we can then wean enough that they can be independent. So we do want to keep that in mind, turn towards our parenting and make priorities for how are we going to accomplish that.
When you say giving enough, could you explain a little bit more?
Giving enough, right. So that's really with every family. It's something that you really have to evaluate, and it probably pays to actually make a list and think about, what do I want to create in my child? So here are some of the things I thought about as workshops. You know, look, let's say you want to give a child, who has hired music teachers for their children in this room? Right? Many of us. What are you trying to give your child? Right? You're spending money, you're schlepping them to the teacher, or you're bringing the teacher into your house, and you're listening to a horrible racket and hocking their china. They should practice, right? Some people see success, some people do not see success. Some people are just flushing their money down the toilet and driving themselves nuts and their kids nuts. But the reason why we do it is we hope that in the end, we will allow them to acquire a gift that we can't give them. You can only acquire it by doing it on your own. The parents can facilitate it. They could pay for the teacher. They could listen to the racket. They could do the driving. They could buy the instrument. But only if the kid practices will...
And is passionate.
You don't even have to be so passionate. You have to practice enough. Maybe you'll be passionate and you can be Pinchas Zuckerman. Or maybe you'll just be able to play the piano or the violin for fun and sing along with it or play the guitar in a basic way. But only the person can acquire the skill for themselves. Nobody can give it to you. There's no magic pill. There's no amount of money any parent can pay to cause their child to have the skill. It's only acquired through the child engaging with the material themselves. All you can do is stand around the outside edge and try to create the environment in which they will become empowered and get that. So the same thing with music is the same thing with other things. Chores around the house. It's not about, I need the help. It's about, I want you to grow into this. Right? My grandmother used to smile sweetly as her kids helped her and say, with my children's help, I get things done in twice the time. So it's not about the help, right? Sometimes it is. You'd like the dishwasher unloaded. It's not about the help, though. It's about they need to know how to unload a dishwasher, how to load a dishwasher, how to make a bed, how to tuck in the corners, how to do laundry, what goes in the dryer, what doesn't go in the dryer, what should you keep out of the way of a housekeeper, what shouldn't you keep? I'm like, how do you do that? That's creating independence, and you can't do that without giving them jobs, right? Without causing them to earn something, set a goal, and achieve it. Okay. That's P. Be proactive for yourself, prioritize for your kids. O is optimistic for yourself. You have to be optimistic that you're going to come out of this well, and hopefully they will too. And for your children, the O stands for original. Turns out they're not you, and they never will be. And it's so hard to let go of that. But we are all created in the image of God, and one thing about God is there's nobody like God. So we're created in that image. There's nobody like us. Nobody like each one of us. We're completely unique and totally original. There never has been and never will be somebody with exactly the parents and exactly the husband and exactly the circumstances and the exact center, the exact situation that you have or that they have. So they're going to be their own person. And for those who are super challenged by their kids making different decisions than they are making, here is my favorite Bostoner Rebbe quote. So the Bostoner Rebbe said that the greatest gift God gave to mankind is free will. And unfortunately, he gave that gift to our children as well. So... Right, so that is part of the gift, which has a double-edged sword. Yes, you get to pick. And yes, you want to show them healthy ways to make choices, but they will be their own self. So that's the W of power, is welcoming. And that's on both sides, for self and for child. Welcoming the newness that comes out of this, the new child, adult that's emerging, and welcoming the new you that's emerging into middle age, into a powerful age. Your past, I would really say that you're really basically almost a child till 40. Right? The first 20 years, your parents raise you. The second 20 years, your children raise you. And then you begin your adulthood somewhere around now, right? And this age, as we have teenagers, or as our teenagers start to take flight, really, when the teenagers take flight, that's a very questioning age for women, right? That early empty nesting time is a time of wondering, who am I now? Now that I'm not so tied to raising these children, who do I want to become? I don't know if you ever saw, we don't have a TV in our house, but I have seen some commercials. Did you ever see that Home Depot commercial? I think it's some people, yeah, where the kids' car is all packed up for college. It's in front of the house, oh, yeah. And it's jammed full of stuff. And the dad's hugging the son goodbye and hug and tears. And the son's like, okay, Dad, I'll see you later. I'm off to college. Where's Mom? And Dad says, well, you know, it's pretty intense for Mom. She's in the house. He says, oh, I understand. So the kid drives away. Meanwhile, you cut to the mom. She's already in the kids' room measuring. The hot tub's going here. So, it is a time of reassessing and reclaiming ourselves. So welcoming the new self that emerges through parenting teenagers, and it's a challenging time, and welcoming the adult that's emerging. You know, that's our new word this century, is emerging adults, because last century's new word was actually teenage. They didn't have that before the 1900s, because before that you were a kid or an adult, right? If you think about bar and bat mitzvah, 12, 13, you're a kid or an adult. There's no in between, right? It was only in the affluence of the 1900s that we were able to have a pause period and create teenagers that didn't have full responsibility yet and were ready to take on adulthood at 18, 19, 20. Today, they're not, right? Really, emerging adult is past teenagehood, deep into the 20s, maybe even up to 30. But you're not considered adult until you're financially independent, living independently, finished with your education, basically. That's one thing to get your PhD or whatever, but like finished with your basic education and paired off, right? Those are some of the markers of adulthood, and many people are not achieving that until 30. So we're in for a long haul. We can speed it up a little bit when we make it clear to our children, this is your job, become independent, and I will foster this. You need a degree, I'll help you with that degree, but then make sure that degree is not in art history, because you can't eat art history. You can eat accounting, but art history provides very little food. So these are conversations to have with your children. Right. So that's welcoming. E for self growth is evaluate. Really take some time to look at yourself and see what is happening here, and are you producing with your efforts the results that you would like to see? Or would you like to produce different results, in which case you need to put in different efforts? So evaluate who you are. And E for our teenagers is engage. So easy to step back, and it's time to step forward. That's what I've seen with growing teens is they need much more time than the little kids. The little kids needed all that physical time. The big kids need not just which school should I pick and what major should I pick and what theme should I put in this paper and can you edit my paper for me? Or rescue me, and I've learned to say no to the rescues. Take it incomplete. I'm not writing your paper for you. I did that with the first kid. The first kid who had no clue that he needed to start a paper early, I was like, okay, I'll write one. The other class you're taking it incomplete. And now I know to say, no, this is not how it works. Let's talk about how you start your papers early. But how do you launch them, right? So engage with them in their process. And then finally, for us, it's reframe. Right? In our own growth. Reframe. Who are you now? Who would you like to be? How do you put a different frame around your life? And allow that to be evolving. And for the children, it's responsibility. How do you encourage them to take responsibility for who they are? I feel like one of the messages that I have as a convert to Judaism is nobody can get away with saying, I wasn't raised that way in front of me. I don't care how you were raised. Nobody in this room was raised with less Jewish background than I was. I read Hebrew fluently, not perfectly. I cannot read a novel in Hebrew. But I can study in Hebrew. I can find a verse. I can figure something out. I can look something up. I know where to turn for resources. And I accomplished it. I'm not saying I did it on my own. I'm not saying I didn't have a ton of helpers along the way. But I figured it out, right? So you can reframe. You can take responsibility. You can create independence. And nobody can say, just because my parents didn't give me enough or gave me too much or abused me or gave me a Mercedes when I was 16 doesn't mean I can't take responsibility for my life and become who I want to become. So we want to get our kids to that place where they take responsibility for their future. So that's really the power of parenting, is give enough to create enough that they're filled up that they can be launched into independence. And I guess I'll stop there. Everybody has to go, but you can ask questions if you want, and whoever needs to go can go. Yeah.
Could you repeat the power again and the
sure.
What they
okay.
Stand for?
So this is just my own thought here. So on the self side, okay, growing yourself.
Thanks.
Be proactive.
Because I grabbed some. I'm trying to
be optimistic that you're going to come out of this well. Welcome your own changes instead of be scared of them. Evaluate where you are right now and make the changes that you want to, and reframe. So evaluation and reframing goes together and goes back into being proactive. Right? It's a process for self, right? And for the kids, raising the kids into healthy adulthood, prioritize. So you are raising them. Prioritize your goals with them. Allow them to be originals. They're not copies of you. Welcome those changes as they emerge. It's welcome for both self and kids. Welcome their changes, who they become. Engage with them. And then allow them, force them, cause them, bring them to take responsibility. So, sure. Pleasure. Any other questions, thoughts, cares, concerns?
Well, you can separate. What's the difference? Like, what is unique to the Jewish perspective that maybe added, like, a little deeper?
Yeah, okay, so good. So what's different about being Jewish? This is good parenting advice for anybody. I would say what makes it particularly Jewish, first of all, is understanding that it is a process that's your own growth, too. It's not just about creating responsible citizens in the world, but it is a growth process of your own transformation through transforming your child and really bringing them to a place of independence. That's also very Jewish. Very Jewish. It's hard as Americans because America really has a lot of Jewish values woven into it. So we might see what we might think of as American values or secular values are really actually very deeply Jewish. Like, for instance, universal education, very deeply Jewish value. The concept that education empowers, that is Jewish at its core. America took that on because they became a Bible-based society, or the initial settlers here, speaking from my 13th-generation American past, my ancestors, the Puritans who came here, were about creating a Bible-based society. And so they took Jewish values in the Torah and tried to create this country with some of those values. So the concept of universal education and that education empowers is 100% Jewish and didn't exist. There was no other country on the planet that had a universal, compulsory education system before America. This is it. This is the only country in the world. But by Jews, and that's why it's important to read the memoirs of Gluckel of Hamelin, anybody who watched Fiddler on the Roof and think that girls were not educated traditionally is completely wrong. It's not true. Girls were always educated, but not in schools. They were educated in their homes and at their mother's knee. You see, when you read her memoir, how educated she is as a person in both secular and sacred studies. She's a very educated young woman in 1690. So that's before Beis Yaakov. Yes, there was a breakdown. And so schools had to be established for girls. But there was an intact transmission, mother to daughter, for quite some time. The male transmission, father to son, broke down really around the destruction of the Second Temple. So they established schools for boys at that time because they couldn't get enough from home. But for girls, it was really an intact, internal, home-based mother-to-daughter transmission really up until the early 1800s, and then it started to break down. So we responded also with schools. But so Jewishly, it is about empowering through education, making sure that people have deep roots and know where they're headed, have clear goals. We've lost a lot of that as a Jewish people. But it's very important to know our roots, what nourishes us, what binds us, what guides us, and then where are we headed? Having a clear direction. It's not a materialistic heading. We need material things in our lives for the sake of accomplishing our goals, but our goals are not materialism. So we need to understand what our goals are and how material things will help us accomplish those goals, not how we sacrifice our whole life to the material. And then creating responsibility, making sure that we have responsible children. My grandmother had so many great sayings, but one of them, I'll give you a country saying, which works very well in Jewish circles, but it's a very hick saying, right? Don't put rocks in your egg basket. That's what she would tell me when she'd catch me reading comics, right? I'd be reading Archie's or Richie Rich, which I loved as a kid, and she couldn't stand it. How would I be spending time, precious reading time, on Narishkeit? I should be reading something real. She would say, look, it's like you're going out to the hen house to pick out the eggs, and you're carrying the basket to bring them home, and on the way you see shiny rocks. And so you pick them up and put them in your egg basket, and now you have no more room for eggs. Don't put rocks in your egg basket. Read real books. So it's a great American saying, but it's definitely something to think about. What kind of rocks are we putting in our egg basket? What's important to us? And are we wasting our time with social media, with silly TV shows or movies? And like, how could we put what's valuable into our lives and leave out what's not?
Well, how do you get your kids? Like, I guess I really struggle with, I don't watch TV. I read, and there are a lot of things. I can't get my kids to join my interests. I can't get my kids to go on a bike ride with me. I can't get my kids to, no, I don't want to do that. No, I don't. And I try to, from the time they were little, try to make it fun, try to make it interesting.
Modeling is very important.
Well, I've been,
and
sorry,
you're doing
model.
Great.
Right.
And then trust the process. They're teenagers. They're not going to do everything you want right now. But when you model it genuinely, and you try to create your home in ways, you might want to, like, I don't know, you'll figure out. You don't have to have a TV in every room, that kind of thing. But
right.
So, but you're modeling, they will come back to it.
Like when they're 30?
maybe even earlier. But the better your marriage is, and the more loving you are, and the warmer the home you're is, the more they're going to want that and be drawn to that. Even if they stray a little now, they come back and they appreciate it. So model and wait. So, and definitely guide along the way, but definitely model and wait, because they will. They do. They seek that out, especially if it's warm. So when it's the caring embrace, and when they really understand, you want that for them, not for you. It's not that you're embarrassed that your kids like just watch TV and don't read books, and you don't want your friends coming over seeing them watching while you're reading, like, and it's such a Shonda, so that's why you want them. Like, that's, if it's that, then they're your little toy, and they don't want to be your little toy, right? But if it's because you care about their brains and what's inside of it, and you want to see them grow and blossom, and there's a whole world of literature out there that can take them to places that they can never go with a TV show, and you want to open that door for them, they'll come to it. They will. I mean, think about how different. I think that's a very important thing to. Yeah, it's a very important thing to anchor yourself in, though. How different are you now than you were when you were 18?
Not very.
No, I know. I was married. No, I didn't grow up watching TV.
I mean, I definitely started a trajectory also at a very young age, but I do see that I've grown a lot. Even if you just
I've grown, but I'm just saying
internal core values are very similar.
Definitely.
So hopefully your kids have picked up some internal core values.
But yeah,
I'm not holding my breath.
How do you continue to make they're not miniature you. They're, you know, a replica of God, and nobody can excel to that level. But ultimately, you said it early on when you made an introduction, you explained to yourself, to us, about your children, how they've made different choices. Mm-hmm. So are you still waiting for them to come around, or have you accepted the fact that you made a choice of making different choices? And how do you allow certain things? How do you take that within yourself and accept that?
So I'm doing both. I'm both waiting and accepting at the same time. So my kids are really mad at me for waiting.
Okay.
Right? So those kids, like I have a 21-year-old who's fabulous. She's straight A's in math, differential equations, biology, physics, like, you know, all that stuff. She's like a brainiac. And she went to Yale last summer she got a paid undergraduate fellowship to do research in the biology, chemistry, and physics department. Okay, great. She's thinking about becoming a petroleum engineer. Who knows what she, that's Colorado, right? Who knows what, right? She's a geek, right? So, but she's atheist.
But she's what?
Atheist. So, and proactively atheist. I don't mean like passively atheist. I mean like evangelizing proactively. Richard Dawkins, Samuel Harris, Daniel Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, proactive atheism. I went to hear Richard Dawkins speak on the CU campus in Boulder. It's Berkeley of the Rockies. So I went to hear him speak there. It was like a revival meeting. It was a fascinating cultural experience to be in that room with people who are all, or mostly, atheists, who are like, Hail Dawkins, Hail Dawkins. They were like, it was amazing what they were like. Like there was electricity in the room, and he was talking about how it's our responsibility as atheists to rid the world of the scourge of religion. We must remove it. It takes away people's ability to have reason and see science as the top paradigm on the planet. And we all have to, you know, he created the Institute for Science and Reason, and he's passing the plate that everybody should give, tithe their time and their money towards creating a planet free of religion. It was literally a revival meeting, and that room was amazing. Anyway, she's that kind of atheist. So, so how do I deal with that? I'm a Torah teacher. I created my whole life around teaching Torah and sharing with people, and I have this kid who's an atheist, and not just some atheist, an evangelizing atheist. Okay. So, at first, I told her, and this is my hope that I maintain, but I don't say it in front of her anymore. I hope that when she's a professor of whatever she is a professor of, that some little co-ed's going to come to her and say, you know, professor, I'm an atheist. And she'll be able to say, you know, when I was your age, I was also an atheist. Let me tell you how I worked it out. So, but if I say that to her, she's like, Ima, you made lifelong decisions way before my age, and you stuck with them. Why do you think I'm not capable of making my own life decisions and determining my path at my age? Right. Okay. She has a steel trap for a memory. I told her once I'd give her $20 if she memorized the Declaration of Independence. Whatever. She didn't get the $20, but she memorized most of it. She didn't get to the end. But she did with that knowledge, write her own Declaration of Independence, which she presented to me with so much fury and frustration. Probably she was 15. And when I read it, it was the most beautiful piece of writing she'd ever produced. I was like, this is great! I'm putting this in your file! And she was like,
I have a
problem. All I want to do is like yell at you, and you're saying this is great, you're putting it in my file? So I took the steam out of that. That's not what I meant to do. I just thought it was so cute. You know, she did not want to be cute. She wanted to be independent. So I have worked on accepting her, and it's not easy. That's not where I want her to be. It's not. And I am maintaining hope, not because I need her to be me, but because I really have found a lot of depth and connection and ability to grow through Torah. And I really think it's the most powerful tool on the planet to create a better me and a better world. And I want her to have access to that tool. And I want her to cut it off. I really feel like her life can be so much deeper. I never could have gotten through all the difficulties I went through raising children, and the difficulties of bearing one, and the difficulties of everything else in my life if I didn't have the Torah. So I love it, I'm thankful for it, and I want her to have access to that. So I still hold that, I hope that she will come to it, and I'm working hard on accepting her for who she is. So I no longer say when she comes over, I mean, now she dresses how she wants to dress, but you know, in the olden days when I used to say, would you like me to sew a ribbon on the bottom of that skirt for you? And they would be able to say, if I wanted a ribbon on the bottom of it, I would have bought it with a ribbon on the bottom of it. So now I just know that... That's,
but there's still a respect.
There's definitely respect. Shabbos is Shabbos in the house. And for, you know, in her own room, I don't have to hear anything, and she makes sure that I don't. So her room is her space, and our house is our space, and she can join us in our space. And so there's definitely respect, definitely. And we've had some hard times with it. And I'm growing, and she's growing, and there's much more respect now than there was in the initial stages, and it was frustrating. Really hard. And I had to forgive myself for being a first-generation Jew and realizing that I don't have all the depth that's necessary to create the perfect home that I thought I was going to create. So who my kids are is not my choice.
Do you feel that it's all on you, though? Because your husband, as a partnership, take
yeah,
on
no,
that
we both,
same...
We both share it. But, so this is what I have realized. Who my kids are is not my choice. How much I love them is. And that's all I have. That's completely in my power, is how much I love them. And so I really try hard to love them and care for them and be there for them. So that's the choice that remains mine. So that's what I really realize. I don't get to pick how they're going to come out. I could pick how I launch, but I can't pick where they're going to land. So that's like the Tom Lehrer song. I don't know if you know Tom Lehrer at all. Do you know him? He's an old political commentator from the 50s, funny songs, but he talks about Wernher von Braun, who invented the... rockets, right? He says, I send them up, but where they come down, it's not my department, says Wernher von Braun. So, that's all I could do. I could send them up, but where they come down, it's not my department. It's their department.
Thank you.
So, yeah.
And this kind of leads into that. How has their spouses played a role in your family dynamics? And
yeah, that's a fascinating thing. So
right.
Turns out my top three are the
religions.
Is it what
you would have thought, or is it different than what you would have thought?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Spouses are our whole thing. Do you have
right.
any married kids yet?
Not yet. 23 and 21, but...
Right. Just,
yeah.
Just curious.
Yeah. So my first one, because I read that book, Memoirs of Bokel Tamlin, I allowed my first one to get married very young. He was 18 when he got engaged and just 19 when he got married to a girl who was 18.
Wow.
And they were very young, but I really saw for them, and they were not a mature 18 and 18. They were 18 and 18. So, but I really saw it as they had found each other. It was very clear this was the match, and I'll just provide the parenting for that couple as a young married. So they got married and moved a few blocks away. Then that apartment, fortunately, fell apart completely. And God arranged it just perfectly that there was a house available right across the street from us into which they moved.
Wow.
And... yeah, and they were back and forth for 5 years. It took 3 years before she asked me, Ima, you always have so much food in your house. How is that? I'm like, well, I shop a lot. and I cook a lot. She said, maybe you could help me make a list of like basic foods I should be keeping in my house. so that I'll also have food in my house, because they came across the street for three meals a day, you know, like breakfast and lunch and dinner every day. So fine. So they were children. They just slept across the street, right? So finally, after 3 years, she asked that question, because I told them when they got married, I said, I have tons of advice for you, tons, but you'll have to ask for it. And I tried so hard to keep my mouth shut, even when she came over with a big belly and a Slurpee and a king-sized Milky Way bar for breakfast. All I could say was, would you like me to make you some eggs? It was so hard not to say, what the heck are you feeding your baby? So anyway, yeah.
So they stay locally.
So she definitely is one of our children, because she was married first into the family, and she's one of the pack. Mm-hmm. She's one of ours. The other ones are in-law children, because they got married to adults, you know, and they got married as adults, and so they weren't shaped by our family. But Gitti was she's definitely from her family too,
right?
And you know, she comes from a family with means. We don't have that, so like, I taught her what Walmart is. Her parents are shocked when she comes home. She comes back from New York wearing like Louis Vuitton shoes and Prada, you know, with little bows. And she tells me how they really are worth $350, those flats, because they're so much more comfortable. I'm like, really? And so her parents, when she goes home, say, you look homeless, and they outfit her. When she comes back to Denver, I'm like, what are you wearing on your body? Like, do you know how much you could buy for that? Like, right. So I finally learned how to shut up about that, too. Like, it's just not my business. Her parents can buy what she wants, and I'll buy what I want. And like, it's just different. Right, but she is one of ours, and people often mix it up. Like, they'll ask her about her time in Long Beach, and she grew up in Muncie. Like, she's not really one of our kids, just everybody thinks she is. So she's one of us. The other kids have influence in different ways, because they do bring their other families. So one's a very good family match to us. So that works out very nicely. And the other has a family that's so, well, the other two, really, they have families that are so different, and they bring that. It's interesting just to see how that is. And Hashem makes the matches. So you just have to trust Hashem that he matched that child with those parents, matched those parents with each other, and matched those in-laws with us as in-laws. You know, there's a word in, that's a Jewish thing, there's a word in Jewish, in Yiddish, for your in-law child's parents, your mechutanim. They have a relationship with you, the mechutanim, right? So we don't have that in English. There's no such word for that. You know, there's not a relationship, but there is. In Jewish families, there's a relationship between the parents. Maybe it's not strong, but it's definitely there. Maybe it's antagonistic, but it's definitely there. It's a relationship. So, it definitely has influenced the family. So what I really try to give space, a lot of space. You know, like, so they say when your kids get married, a new chapter opens up in your life. It's called chapter 11. But anyway, that's what I told them. I have a lot of advice for you. I have lots to tell you, but you're going to have to ask for it. And then I really try hard to keep my mouth shut and let them ask. And they do. They do. Both of the kids do. The in-law kids and the birth kids do come and ask for advice. So
I have a question. I don't know if this is typical now or not, but in some Orthodox families, if your child is not Orthodox and marries someone who's not Jewish, some disown or sit shiva, or
that's in the olden days.
They don't do that anymore.
They might disown, but nobody sits shiva anymore, as far as I know. And that's because marriages don't necessarily last today. So just because you're getting married doesn't mean that you really married out. But not just that, it's even more fundamental that most people don't realize how essential it is to have a Jewish spouse. So actually marrying a non-Jew today doesn't mean that that person is throwing away their Judaism proactively, whereas it did mean that 100 years ago. 100 years ago, a Jew who married a Gentile knew that they were cutting themselves off from Jewish eternity and Jewish roots. And so that's why they would sit shiva, because that person died Jewishly. And they would sit shiva for the death. But that's not the case today. So we don't have that. I mean, I'm sure there's some families who maybe do, but that's not the general practice today. There's certainly the sorrow and the hope that that would never happen, and I hope I never have to face that. It's not right there, but I hope that's not going to be one of my challenges. And I heard Rav David Cohen, who's one of the top halachic advisors of the country, speak about it. But he said, we do hold that marriages don't, just because somebody got married doesn't mean it's permanent. So our response today,
that's the way they go into it.
Our response today is patience, but also active outreach to the non-Jewish partner.
Okay.
That's the Orthodox response that's supposed to be active outreach to the non-Jewish partner.
But that's not Sephardic way.
No, the Sephardic way is different. Yes, it is. No, so we definitely still have. I mean, we for sure don't want it.
Right.
And we would definitely try to create the social pressure of a lack of acceptance at first.
Right, because my husband's family is from, they're Sephardic from New York, and mm-hmm. it's a whole...
Yeah, what kind of Sephardic?
Sephardic. There's only one Sephardic.
No, no, there's not. There's Syrian, there's Moroccan, like, there's
Syrian.
Greeks. They're Syrians. Syrians are anti-converts.
Right.
Syrians,
right.
Syrians, in order to prevent interdating,
right.
because the Syrians definitely, the Syrian males definitely had a shikzazar for practice mentality.
Right.
And so it turns out if you practice on non-Jewish women, you might fall in love with one of them, and you might want to marry them, no problem, you'll convert them. So in order to prevent interdating, they said no conversions.
Yeah, which is interesting, because in the Ashkenazi, it's a mitzvah almost to convert.
Kind of. There
but,
is a mitzvah.
But in Sephardic, it's very different.
In Syrian, it's not. That's why I asked specifically.
Syrian
is very anti-convert, because
right.
it started out as a decree for North America. It did not exist before North America. When they came to North America, so that's Mexico and the United States,
right.
they made that decree, no conversions. But that was to guard against the interdating, but it turned into a very anti, it just morphed away from its original intention
right.
into a very anti-convert stance.
Right, because my husband got married very late, mm-hmm. and we would come back to New York, they would say, there's got to be one, you know,
right.
like they were so strong mm-hmm. about
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And even though I'm not Sephardic,
they'll accept you.
Yeah.
At least you're Jewish from birth.
Right.
Right. Good. That's good. I had a convert friend, a male convert friend, who told me he wants to marry an FFB, which is usually religious from birth. I said, FFB? Really? You want from birth? He said, female from birth, and I am not compromising. Like, okay, I think we could at least find that for you.
Did yes. Did park on the outside of the driveway?
I did. My car behind you?
Yeah.
What car are you?
What led you to become a Jew?
Really, it's such a good question, and I have so little answer for that because it was really a God-directed thing.
Yes,
I was 14 when my friends did. I was 10 when I became atheist, and 14 when my friends did. So I went through a searching process.
Maybe I didn't believe in God,
it's not the Christian God concept that I was raised with.
Yes,
I'm
still
right.
Sorry, around heavy.